President Trump has postponed planned military strikes against Iranian energy infrastructure. The decision, which was broadcast via social media, triggered an immediate and sharp rebound in the markets, with the Nasdaq and S&P 500 surging as investors pivoted back to a risk-on sentiment. Look, the White House just blinked in its standoff with Iran, and the stock market is treating it like a national holiday. While the immediate threat of a regional war has cooled off, the underlying math, specifically the price of oil and the yield on the 10-year Treasury, is still calling the shots. It seems the bond market is the only thing this administration actually listens to. Here is what you need to know for Tuesday, March 24th. While the immediate threat of escalation has receded, the situation remains incredibly fragile. Reports suggest ongoing discussions around Iranian energy infrastructure, including key island terminals like Karg Island, and the U.S. is still reinforcing its troop presence in the region. This suggests that despite the off-ramp provided by the president's tweets, the conflict could still stretch into weeks rather than days. The real pressure here wasn't just diplomacy, it was the bond market. Before the president even sent those tweets, the 10-year Treasury yield saw a significant shift. When that yield rises, borrowing costs for the entire American economy go up. It looks like the bond market acted as a kill switch on military aggression. It's a bit of a recurring theme with this administration. The rhetoric is loud, but the moment the 10-year yield spikes and threatens the domestic economy, the policy does a 180. There's also a heavy dose of domestic math at play. Between upcoming midterm elections and negative polling on military action, the White House is stuck. Rising gas prices are a political death sentence, and a broad coalition of advisors likely pointed out that a prolonged war would gut the president's base. Now, if we look at the mechanics of why we're even in this position with Iran and Gaza, there is a very specific historical pattern at play. According to reports, U.S. regime change typically follows a six-step process. A nation has a resource. They try to control it themselves. U.S. corporate interests feel threatened. The U.S. frames the intervention as an ideological fight, like fighting terrorism, and then we intervene to protect the profits. In the case of Iran, the stated concern is nuclear proliferation. But the report suggests that's a pretext for dismantling Iran's defensive capabilities to make them more malleable to business interests. We're seeing a similar vibe in Gaza. Instead of framing it purely as a humanitarian crisis, figures like Jared Kushner are reportedly looking at it as a real estate development opportunity. It's a grim reality when you realize that for some of these guys, a war zone is just a plantation waiting for a luxury high-rise. This brings us to the energy markets. If this conflict picks back up and hits Iranian power plants, oil could realistically hit $150 a barrel. Michael Haig at Societe Generale notes that we're looking at a potential supply disruption of 17% of global oil. For context, the 1973 oil crisis was only a 7% disruption. Interestingly, not everyone at the Federal Reserve is panicking. Fed Governor Christopher Waller has been a notable voice pushing for a cautious approach to interest rates. The argument from the dovish side of the bank is that while oil shocks hit the headline inflation numbers, they haven't started a wage price spiral yet. They're looking 18 months down the road and think the risk of unemployment from a slowing economy is now just as dangerous as the risk of inflation. General Stanley McChrystal has some thoughts on why our military strategy keeps hitting these same walls. He argues that the U.S. is seduced by the idea of surgical strikes and air power. We think we can just drop a few precision bombs and solve a problem, but that ignores the deep-seated historical grievances these countries have. Iran isn't just reacting to last week. They're reacting to the 1953 coup and the 1979 embassy crisis. McChrystal likens the Iranian commitment to that of North Vietnam. Basically, you can't bomb a population into submission when they have a theological or historical commitment to the fight. He's also worried about the civilian-military divide in the U.S. We have a professional warrior class that is increasingly insulated from the rest of us. He's advocating for mandatory national service to bridge that gap. It's a nice idea, but considering our current political climate, getting everyone to agree on a national service program feels about as likely as a peaceful weekend in the Strait of Hormuz. While the U.S. is debating whether to strike, Russia is busy proving that a war economy can actually be a growth engine, at least in the short term. They've pioneered what one analyst is calling Smirnonomika, or death economics. Despite all the sanctions, Russia's economy hasn't collapsed. But the real driver is the massive government payouts to soldiers and their families. We're talking about signing bonuses and death benefits that can exceed what a person would earn in an entire lifetime. This creates a macabre form of economic stimulus. It pumps billions into the poorest regions of Russia, which keeps people quiet and keeps the recruitment lines full. Putin is essentially mortgaging Russia's future to pay for the present. By depleting the workforce and funneling everything into military production, he's setting the stage for a massive crash once the war eventually stops. But for now, the death benefits are keeping the lights on in Moscow. Finally, a quick look at the tech side of this geopolitical mess. The concentration of risk in the U.S. tech sector is becoming a major concern as AI adoption accelerates. Because of tariffs, U.S.-China trade has dropped, but China is just moving upstream into intermediate goods. There is a massive wave of foreign investment flowing into data centers globally. AI is the new oil in this sense. It's driving military spending and reshaping which companies have a moat and which are about to get disrupted. The takeaway here is that you can't look at a tweet about Iran in a vacuum. It's all connected. The 10-year treasury yield, the price of a barrel of crude, the death economics in Russia, and the data centers being built in the desert. It's a complicated, cynical, and highly expensive game of chicken. On a side note, lawmakers are finally looking at the prediction markets like DraftKings and Flutter Entertainment. They're preparing legislation to bar these platforms from offering contracts that look like sports bets, but are actually speculative financial instruments. Apparently, the line between a derivative and a parlay is getting a bit too blurry for Congress. Not that they're one to talk about gambling with the future, but here we are. So while the White House is managing the geopolitical mess, they're also trying to figure out how to keep AI from breaking the internet. The White House has officially released a 4-page legislative framework designed to establish a single national AI policy. The goal here is to get ahead of a messy, state-by-state patchwork of laws. But the real kicker, and the part that's going to keep lawyers busy for a decade, is a provision stating that training AI models on copyrighted material does not violate copyright law. It's a massive olive branch to big tech and a middle finger to content creators. According to the reports, this is already shaping up to be a brutal legislative fight that could actually stall federal action entirely. The framework also outlines a 6-point plan to protect children and prevent censorship, but the response has been lukewarm at best. Honestly, a 4-page document trying to regulate the most complex technology in human history feels a bit like bringing a pocket knife to a railgun fight. Meanwhile, OpenAI is moving to consolidate its power. They're reportedly developing a super app that merges ChatGPT, their Codex programming tool, and the Atlas browser. The second-order effect here is the data. By pulling everything into one app, OpenAI creates a massive advertising vehicle. Microsoft, despite being OpenAI's biggest benefactor, is starting to show some teeth. They are reportedly considering legal action against OpenAI and Amazon. The issue? OpenAI made a deal with AWS, which Microsoft claims violates their exclusive cloud arrangement on Azure. It's a classic frenemy situation. Microsoft is helping OpenAI grow while simultaneously building the tools to eventually replace them. On the hardware side, NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang is predicting over $1 trillion in AI demand by 2027. He just unveiled the Vera Rubin platform, pushing a new metric, tokens per watt. But Elon Musk is tired of waiting for NVIDIA's chips. He's proposing TerraFab, a $25 billion vertically integrated factory to build chips for Tesla, SpaceX, and xAI. We are witnessing a civilization-scale build-out of compute. The reality on the ground is that AI agents are still brittle. As the reports note, they require massive amounts of human context engineering to actually work. we're building the infrastructure for a god. But for now, we're mostly using it to automate the boring stuff. It's a lot of noise. But sometimes you just want to look at something that actually moves in the real world, like a horse running very fast around a track. Full Effort just won the Jeff Ruby Stakes, and it wasn't particularly close. This victory officially puts him on the map for the Kentucky Derby, mostly because he finally got the distance his trainer, Brad Cox, has been asking for. Cox has been saying for a while that this horse just needed more ground to mature, and moving him to a more forward racing style seems to have unlocked something. Now, the plan is to move Full Effort to Churchill Downs immediately. Look, he's probably not going to be the betting favorite on the first Saturday in May, but his closing speed is legitimate. If the front runners get tired, or the pace gets stupid, he's exactly the kind of horse that ends up in the winner's circle while everyone else is wondering what happened. The Jeff Ruby also gave us Star Contrast, who finished a strong second. His connections are in a bit of a spot now. They haven't committed to a Derby run yet, because frankly, he looks like a much better turf runner. Right now, they're leaning toward the American Turf Stakes instead. Here's the thing about this weekend's results. We're seeing this trend where trainers are moving horses from turf to dirt later in the season, basically treating the early months as a developmental league. It's a smart, calculated way to build a contender, but it also feels a little like gaming the system. Honestly, the whole Derby fever thing usually leads to people making bad decisions with good horses. You see it every year. Owners pushing a turf specialist onto the dirt, just because they want to see their colors in the Derby walkover. At least with Cox and Full Effort, there's a logic to it. He's a horse that's actually getting better as the races get longer. It's not just about speed anymore, it's about who's still standing at the mile and a quarter mark. Full Effort looks like he's still standing, which in this game is half the battle. Of course, the business side of sports is rarely as straightforward as a sprint to the finish line. Major League Baseball is officially moving toward a tech-driven strike zone. The league is introducing the Automated Ball Strike, ABS, challenge system. Look, we all knew this was coming the second we saw the first digital K-zone on a broadcast. It's a foundational change that's going to ripple down through player development and how umpires are trained. While baseball looks at robots, other sectors are betting on expansion. The sports agency Wasserman is reportedly exploring a sale, drawing interest from heavy hitters like UTA and WME. Meanwhile, in Atlanta, Arthur Blank is putting serious money into soccer infrastructure. It's a smart move, honestly. Blank sees the direction the wind is blowing, and it's smelling a lot like Ted Lasso and massive media rights deals. Over in the NFL, however, the labor side of things looks a bit messy. The NFL Players Association recently elected J.C. Treader as executive director, but the process has been criticized for a lack of transparency. The union actually amended its constitution back in 2022 to keep the identities of finalists secret from the voting body until the very last second. Critics say this was a backdoor deal designed to favor insiders. The union's leadership argues this secrecy is necessary, but it feels more like they're weaponizing member apathy. That's a risky bet. The NFL is currently moving toward an 18-game season. If the union stays this compliant, they're going to have zero leverage when the league eventually decides they'd rather keep that cash for themselves. Finally, as we head into the Sweet 16, the betting markets are shifting their focus toward coaching. Analysis suggests that first four momentum, like what we're seeing with Texas, can often outweigh a talent deficit. Basically, if you're staring at the bracket, stop looking at the school names and start looking at who's holding the clipboard. That same struggle between data and vibes is playing out in the media world too, where some people are selling out and others are just trying to look cool. Jennifer Quigley Jones, the founder of the influencer agency Digital Voices, has sold her company to the integrated media firm PMG. This signals a shift in how the creator economy is being swallowed up by larger media machines. Digital Voices was originally a bootstrapped operation that eventually took on angel investment because, as Quigley Jones noted, securing VC capital as a solo female founder is notoriously difficult. They developed a proprietary tech stack to differentiate themselves. According to Quigley Jones, the sale to PMG was driven by a gap in the market. Clients want integrated strategies that tie influencer work into programmatic and experiential media. It's a classic grow or get eaten scenario. There's a specific detail in her account of the deal that sticks out regarding the female founder tax. Quigley Jones mentioned the constant pressure to push back against the perception that she was just running a lifestyle business, a patronizing label often slapped on profitable companies led by women. She eventually brought in experienced bankers to fend off lowball offers that she felt were tied to being an underestimated founder. It worked. Meanwhile, over at CNN, there is a very different kind of identity crisis unfolding. The network has been aggressively pushing its top-tier talent, specifically Anderson Cooper and Jake Tapper, into more casual podcast-style formats. Basically, the suits at CNN noticed that people like podcasts, so they told their multi-million-dollar anchors to stop being so newsy and start being more authentic. But there's a massive friction point here. CNN is trying to solve the innovator's dilemma, but they're doing it while clinging to a legacy brand built entirely on gravitas and authority. And look, it's not working. The strategy assumes that authenticity is just a synonym for casual, which is a fundamental misunderstanding of why people listen to podcasts. When you have a guy in a $5,000 suit sitting in a multi-million-dollar studio trying to act chill while discussing a geopolitical crisis, it doesn't feel authentic. It feels like a corporate simulation of a personality. It's the media equivalent of a dad wearing his son's Supreme hoodie to a PTA meeting. The risk for CNN isn't just that they fail to capture the kids, it's that they alienate the loyal viewers they already have. By devaluing the authority of Cooper and Tapper, they're lighting their most expensive assets on fire. When you look at these two stories side by side, the contrast is pretty sharp. You have Digital Voices, a small, disciplined agency that built real tech and real profits to prove it belonged in the big leagues. Then, you have CNN, a massive institution that is so terrified of the future it's trying to wear the skin of a startup. One of these is a strategic evolution, the other is a midlife crisis being broadcast in 4K. The reality is that authenticity can't be manufactured by a committee. Digital Voices got bought because they had 9 years of hard data and a profitable niche. CNN is struggling because they think they can buy cool by making Jake Tapper sit on a stool instead of behind a desk. It's a shitty position to be in, honestly. You can't eventize the news by being less serious about it. And while the media giants struggle with their midlife crises, maybe there's a lesson in just doubling down on the stuff that doesn't change. Jeff Bezos and Amazon famously built a massive empire by ignoring what changes and focusing on what stays the same. Recent reporting suggests that mindset is being pitched as a survival strategy for the rest of us. The idea is to anchor yourself to unchanging human needs, things like the desire for progress and the need to feel like you matter. By building a peaceful base of family, friends, and financial stability, the argument goes, you can stop reacting to every AI-driven panic. It's a nice sentiment, honestly. But it's a bit rich to use the Amazon model for peace of mind, when that company's actual infrastructure is basically a logistical anxiety machine. Still, the point stands. Chasing every new tool is a treadmill. Focusing on the infrastructure of your own life is probably the only way to not lose your mind. Speaking of life changes, creator Quinn Nelson recently detailed how becoming a parent forced a total rewiring of his professional life. He's shifted to a fragmented workflow, outsourcing brain drain tasks like bookkeeping to save his limited cognitive bandwidth for actual creative work. It's the classic grind culture versus reality. It's easy to talk about maximal effort until you have a human being who needs a nap and a diaper change. Nelson's take is a good reminder that the best work is subjective. If your productivity metrics are killing your personal life, the metrics are the problem, not you. Of course, if your personal life is actually just obsessing over Fantasy Premier League, you've got a different set of problems this week. Look, the FPL season is entering that frantic final stretch where the game stops being about who's good at football and starts being about who's good at reading a spreadsheet. We're heading into Game Week 32, And the big news is the chaos the FA Cup is currently dumping onto the schedule. The central conflict right now is the wild card. Some analysis suggests a strong push to pull the trigger and wild card immediately in Game Week 32 to set up a massive bench boost for Game Week 33. But there's a catch. If you wild card now, you're basically guessing. We don't actually know what the doubles look like yet because they're contingent on FA Cup results. Other reports are waving a massive red flag on that strategy. They're pointing out that rushing a wild card in 32 might actually make your team worse for the immediate week. The alternative is to hold steady, maybe use a free hit in 33, and save that wild card for later in the season. On the player front, things are just as messy. Newcastle's TAA is currently a hold despite being benched recently. Then you've got Mbeumo at Brighton. He's seeing his minutes squeezed, and the attacking returns just aren't there. Over at Liverpool, Ekitike is dealing with a dead leg. Bournemouth's Morgan Rogers is looking like a trap. Despite a recent assist, his underlying numbers are garbage. Here's the thing. FPL is currently a game of chicken with the FA Cup. If you wildcard now, you're betting on specific teams winning their real-world matches, so your digital team gets two games instead of one. It's a high-risk, high-reward play that honestly feels a bit like gambling on a hurricane. Personally, I'm skeptical of anyone claiming they've solved the schedule before the FA Cup whistles blow. It's a shitty time to be making permanent decisions. Before we get out of here, I've got a few more things worth knowing before you head out the door. First up, LA's traffic is legendary for all the wrong reasons, but it would actually be significantly worse without a system called ATSAC. It was built for the 84 Olympics and basically turned thousands of independent stoplights into a giant sensor-driven network. It cuts delays by about 30%, which is great, but it's also a reminder that we're basically just cells in a giant sweating motherboard. Then there's the Matilda effect. It's the fancy term for why women get written out of scientific history. It's actually a mathematical certainty. Small biases in who gets cited early on compound over time until the person who did the work is basically invisible. It's systemic erasure by way of an algorithm, which is somehow more depressing than a single villain. On the environmental front, we are quite literally sinking. We're pumping groundwater out of aquifers so fast that the land above them is collapsing and salt water is leaking into the remains. Once that happens, the water is gone for good. It's a slow-motion disaster that we're mostly ignoring because it's happening underground. And finally, the publishing and film industries are still clinging to the tired myth that black superheroes don't sell. Even after Black Panther made all the money in the world, executives still treat it like a one-off freak accident. It puts this insane pressure on black creators to be perfect every single time, while white-led projects are allowed to fail upwards forever. So the world isn't ending today, but the price of admission is still going up. Go build a peaceful base, or hide your phone, or whatever you need to do to stay sane.